Good afternoon. You know, I didn't make this connection before it was mentioned just a moment ago about everybody up here being, almost everybody here being a former AT&T employee. I am too. And it was a very long time ago, so long ago that I don't even mention it in my bio anymore, but it's back when AT&T had a real sense of humor and thought that it would be a good idea to put a French major in an engineering training program. So I think it was an interesting formative experience, both for the different things that I had to learn very quickly. And I think it does bring home the idea that what you do in your career does affect how you come to a problem, how you try to solve it. The work that I just concluded doing at Georgetown has really attuned me to making sure that you ask the right question. Right? Social science is all about research questions, and you go nowhere with your research unless you really pin down a good question. And so inherent in the title of this session, New Technologies and Services and Telecommunications, Effects on Competition and Investment, a number of good questions built in there. But I'd like to step back and ask maybe a preceding question, which is, what are the problems that are worth solving with new services and technologies? Why do we do this? What is in it for consumers? What do they want? And why should that attract investment? And I'm going to talk a little bit about nominate one problem, one question for consideration in this framework, and then use a case study based on a project that I'm working on right now to illustrate a way of approaching such a question. So my nomination, one problem worth addressing, is universal and affordable broadband. Now, this isn't a topic that you necessarily would come to a conference that's focused on state regulation and state regulatory roles to talk about unless you really had an appetite for pain and wanted to talk about the Universal Service Fund. It's a question that's going to be teed up at NARUC. The winter meeting is starting tomorrow up in Washington, and the joint board will have a hearing on Tuesday about how do we attack this problem of broadband. I think there's increasingly a case that maybe what we want to do is leapfrog the wireline version of that question and come to see how wireless technologies might help us attack the problem. The idea of universal and affordable broadband is becoming is right up there with apple pie and Chevy's, or becoming so. The president has articulated the goal of ubiquitous broadband by 2007. Speaker Pelosi has put forward a Democratic innovation agenda that calls for an investment into sustained federal research and development initiative that promotes private-public partnerships, and also guarantees affordable access to broadband technology for all Americans within 5 years. This is a restatement of an old goal. Many of you know that in Section 706 of the 96 Act, the FCC was directed to look periodically at what there may be in the law and regulation as providing obstacles, with the goal of affording access to advanced services for all Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion. So there's pretty broad agreement that this is a goal worth pursuing. But we're not doing so well. If you look at international organizations that keep track of where we are, both Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and ITU don't have us doing so well with respect to others in the global economy. The ITU has us at 12th in broadband penetration, and have us rank not very well, pretty low, with respect to speed-to-price ratios among industrial nations. Now, there's an answer to this criticism that the United States is slightly bigger than, say, South Korea, and that we have a much larger footprint to outfit. But still, the numbers do count, and we are in an economy that, a global economy that depends increasingly on information flows, and we have an obligation to try to deliver quality service to all Americans. Even if you don't want to pay great attention to how the world looks at us and how the world ranks us, look at how we're doing internally. 59% of low-income American kids don't have internet access. The Department of Education reports that 59% of children from homes that make less than $20,000 don't have access to the Internet. Minority children are also disadvantaged. 56% of Hispanic and 53% of black elementary and nursery school students do not have Internet access. So what's needed, my own view is that a third pipe is needed. And this is in part an artifact of the way that the capital investment flows have worked to invest the ability to provide this infrastructure in two major types of providers, the cable companies and the predominant telephone companies. But there are also regulatory artifacts that have brought us to this point. It's getting a lot harder to borrow facilities, to lease facilities from incumbents. And it's never been the case that it's all that easy to do that with respect to cable companies. So potential new entrants, ISPs and DBS companies, find themselves increasingly stranded because they don't have access to infrastructure. They need resources to build their own, and they're becoming sort of landlocked potential new entrants. So this brings me to the idea that maybe wireless is a way of leapfrogging this. It's because of the spread out density of the U.S. population and our far-flung geography, it's difficult to achieve universal access through wireline technologies. There are also continual affordability problems. And so I present to you a possible solution in the form of a case study, a company, an upstart called M2Z Networks, on whose application before the FCC I've been working. Now here's the idea in a nutshell. M2Z Networks has asked the FCC to allow it to use 20 megahertz of unpaired spectrum located at 2155, 2175 on the spectrum map. It asked for a nationwide 15-year exclusive license to deploy a national broadband radio service. The service would be classified as CMRS, and there would be two kinds of service that would be offered pursuant to this application. The first would be a free service. That service would operate at speeds comparable to the low end of DSL, 384 down and 128 up. The second kind of service would be a subscription service that M2Z Networks would offer on a wholesale basis through partners like rural telephone companies. We hope we've been talking to Rural Lex about potential partnerships, because it would be very valuable to have access to facilities in remote parts of the country that would enable us to accelerate our build-out by giving us access to backhaul. That the price of the wholesale offering would be set by the partners offering it, and it would be up to them to decide what the right price point is. We think certainly that decision would be informed by the availability of cable modem or DSL service. The free service would be supported by geographically relevant search tools, so that we can tell what zip code you're searching from, and if you type in pizza, we can make sure that you get search results that are relevant to where you are, as opposed to restaurant reviews of Chicago deep dish pizza, which may be appetizing but not terribly relevant if you're in Gainesville. This spectrum that we've asked for permission to use is currently unscored. There's no plan to auction it. There are MDS 1, 2, and 2A occupants in it, but they've already been directed to move. Whoever wants to use that spectrum has the responsibility of paying for that transition, which M2Z Networks is prepared to do. The spectrum is unpaired, which is unusual. Most spectrum in upper 700, for example, that the public safety responders will get to use once the digital TV transition is finished. That's all paired spectrum, so you're using one set of frequencies to transmit and another set of frequencies to receive. This technology, which is time division duplex, will use the same frequencies to send and receive. We're asking the FCC to allow us to pay for the spectrum as we go, to give 5% of the revenues to the federal treasury, as opposed to buying the spectrum at auction. And that, as you might expect, is a very controversial aspect of the proposal and is a basis that a number of the incumbents have articulated for opposing the application. So I'll leave this slide up for a moment and just answer a couple of questions that I anticipate people have when I talk about this. One question people have is this for real? Another is, can you really do that? And the third is, are you crazy? The answers are yes, yes, and probably, but not on this account. Is it for real? The people who are backing this are the same people who backed Google and MySpace. We're gratified that they share the vision that this can really be a revolutionary thing that puts an increasingly important tool of civic discourse, use of government services, finally in the hands of people in an affordable way. Can you really do this? Yes. We have first mover but not proprietary advantage on some technology, smart antennas and beam-forming technology that makes extremely efficient use of the spectrum and allows us to deploy a nationwide network in a very efficient manner. I should say that a feature of the application, the proffer that we've made to the FCC is, if you grant this license, we expect you to impose upon us a build-out schedule, not a substantial service kind of arrangement that most CMRS providers get, but an actual build-out schedule. If we miss the dates, we lose the license. And the benchmarks are 95% within 10 years of granted license, 66% within 5, and 33% within 3. And those, it's of population, 95 and 66 and 33 of population. We will have no proprietary interest in the device, the CPE device that the consumer will use. We hope it will be an open standard, and we hope everybody who makes router-type devices that you use in your home today, we hope they'll make them too. They'll make this card too, this chip too. We would be involved just to certify that it works on the network. And we think that will help drive costs down very substantially, very quickly. So this service is both fixed and nomadic. It's not fully mobile. And we think that a lot of people will use it as an adjunct to their existing broadband providers. I have an EBDO account, and I even have a T-Mobile account. And I spend a lot of money every month that I wish I didn't have to spend so that I can respond quickly to emails wherever I am. A service at $384 would probably not cause me to disconnect my cable modem service, which I love, but it would be a real convenience for times when you can't drag the cable modem with you. We also, in line with what Ms. McDonald was saying about parental control, we've told the FCC, look, we think that this is going to be, especially our free service, is going to look a lot like broadcast. We don't know who is on the other end of that search query or that browsing session. And so we've offered to provide a network-based filter. You don't have to be an IT administrator in your own home to make it work. It's in the network. And so we've offered to provide a network-based filter to protect minors from indecent material that is increasingly easy to find on the internet. Let me come to what I think are some of the challenges that something like this presents for regulators. Right off the top, we're asking the FCC to do something that requires a little imagination. It has become kind of a religion in Washington that the only way to allocate spectrum is through an auction. And there have been some successes with auctions and some failures. The failures have to do with the difficulty of new entrants to come in to acquire spectrum. They have to do with the lifting of spectrum caps that make it feasible for incumbents to acquire a lot of spectrum and not even have to use it if they don't want to. So the statute, Section 309 of the Budget Act, gives the Commission the authority to allocate spectrum without an auction, and we're urging them to use that authority. So this step of imagination that we're asking the Commission to take, we invite them to do it by laying out the very substantial public interest benefits that we think this, this plan affords. And so it really serves up, I think, to the regulators an equation of the risk of doing something innovative in order to obtain very substantial near-term benefits for consumers. And that is, I think, really laying a juicy and attractive problem at regulators that I hope they'll attack with gusto. The other aspect of this is that state regulators are usually cordoned off from spectrum policy and wireless regulation issues as a result of the 96 Act and what went before, preempted from acting in these areas except in some consumer settings. That's not quite right as a matter of responsibility and accountability. Increasingly, state regulators and local officials are being pressed to provide this basic utility of broadband access to their citizens. So more than ever, state regulators and local officials have a stake in these spectrum policy decisions. And then on the role of public-private partnerships, a feature of Speaker Pelosi's agenda and always an interesting subject in the telecom area, this system would be built out entirely with private funds. We have about $400 million in funds committed to the build-out, and we think it should not be difficult to raise the rest if we get permission to use the spectrum. And it will not draw upon universal service in any measure. In fact, as a CMRS provider, MTV networks would be paying into the Universal Service Fund. So I think this is served up, I think, in an appropriate way for regulators of every jurisdiction to think about how we should responsibly allocate and optimize this extremely valuable public resource, the spectrum, to really aim it at a problem that's worth solving and do it with imagination and with expeditious attention. Thank you very much.